From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Gelton, and this is On Point. Congress is wrapping up President Trump's tax reform Christmas present, mostly behind closed doors. The most important item in the package, a massive tax cut for corporations, is in the final stage of negotiation. Trump promised a 15% rate across the board, down from the current rate of 35, well, maybe down to 20. Now maybe 22. Whatever the final number, it's going to be a big tax cut. The hope, it will boost the economy, bring higher wages and more jobs. But there are some doubts. This hour On Point, the corporate tax cut and what it means. You can join us on air or online. What do you think of the massive cuts for businesses being proposed? Will they help the economy, hurt the economy? You can, of course, join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And later this hour, we're going to look at another provision of the tax bill, and that's how some tax changes might affect graduate students. But first, let's review some of the promises and doubts around this proposed tax bill. First, here's President Trump. He was speaking at the White House in September in a meeting with lawmakers from both parties. Here he is speaking about the GOP tax plan one day ahead of its release.
The jobs will start pouring in from all over the world, coming back to our country. They've left our country, so many of the jobs, and they'll be coming back in because we have a non-competitive tax structure right now, and we're going to go super competitive.
That was President Trump talking about in particular, the proposed tax cut for corporations. He's joined in that optimistic assessment of what effect it will have by the Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan. On November 15th, Paul Ryan explained to CNBC why he thought fixing the tax code for corporations was so important.
We don't get this done. Those companies that are sitting back and waiting for us to fix this tax code, they're going to leave. I know this because I talk to a lot of these businesses.
And that was Speaker of the House Paul Ryan talking about why he thinks that cutting the corporate tax rate would, in fact, bring back a lot of businesses that might now be tempted to go overseas. Finally, some skepticism from Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer. In an interview with NPR earlier this month, he said the country would be better off if Republicans don't pass their tax bill.
It also gives tax breaks, huge tax breaks, to the wealthiest of corporations. These corporations are flush with money already. They're not creating jobs. More money isn't going to have them create.
And joining me now from Washington is Sahil Kapoor. He is the national political reporter for Bloomberg News. He's been following the debate and the negotiations to the extent he can for Bloomberg News. His story yesterday was headlined, "Here's where the tax debate stands right now." You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Sahil, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
So that was your story yesterday, where the tax debate stands right now. Fill us in today. Where does the tax debate stand right now?
Well, the House Republicans met to discuss the way forward. Their goal is to get a conference report ideally out by the end of this week so that members can have the weekend to look it over, to chew over it, and ideally to have a vote next week. It would be early in the week for the House. It would be later in the week for the Senate. And the idea is to have both chambers pass the same bill so they can send it to President Trump before the holidays.
Yeah, well, both chambers do have to pass the same bill before it can go to the White House. You know, Sahil, there has been some talk of the House just passing the Senate bill as it stands, in which case the Senate wouldn't have to do anything. They could just, after the House approves, they could go straight to the White House. Is it now clear that whatever changes come out of the conference, or that the conference will change the bill enough that it will have to go back to the Senate?
It's certainly the goal to have the bill change from what the House passed and what the Senate passed. They want to find some compromises, and there are a bunch of glitches. The Senate bill in particular, the House bill, they're both riddled with glitches because they were drafted pretty quickly. So there are corrections that need to be made. But what you describe is the last-ditch option. That's a nightmare scenario where, hypothetically, assume Doug Jones, the Democratic candidate in Alabama, wins tonight. They fall under 50 votes in the Senate for this tax bill, and conference negotiations drag on, then the House will have no choice but to accept the Senate bill unless they want the status quo. In that scenario, I could see the House potentially taking it, but that's a nightmare scenario that Republicans are not thinking about right now.
And what are the big differences between the House and the Senate bill that will have to be worked out in conference?
Right. So a few things. The rates are structured differently. The Senate bill has more rates. It keeps 7 existing rates. It cuts the top rate a little bit for millionaires. The House bill maintains the 39.6 existing rate for millionaires. The House bill repeals the estate tax entirely. The Senate bill simply doubles the exemption. One of the big sticking points is going to be the issue of pass-through entities, these small businesses and partnerships, closely held sole proprietorships included, like Trump Organization. They are dealt with very differently in the House bill and the Senate bill. So they're going to have to figure out whether to go with a rate with some limitations like the House bill of 25%, or in the case of the Senate bill, offer a 23% deduction for pass-through incomes up and down the spectrum.
Now, Sahil, we know that the bill passed in the Senate only after some pretty frantic negotiations, and there were a number of senators who agreed to vote for it only at the last minute, and each of them had their own sort of conditions or reasons for supporting it. Will the changes that the House makes to the Senate bill jeopardize any of the votes in the Senate that came to that bill only at the last minute? I'm thinking of Senator Collins and Senator Flake and others.
Right. So that's precisely the delicate balance that they have to strike in conference negotiations. They have to hold 218 Republicans in the House and 50 out of 52 Republicans in the Senate. Now, you mentioned Senator Collins. She's one of the people on the bubble right now. She supported the bill, but after she got assurances that that Congress will pass 2 Obamacare stabilization measures that seem to have legs in the Senate, but that the House Republicans are not at all fond of. It doesn't seem like those can pass the House. The question on my mind is, does that jeopardize Senator Collins' vote? She's worried that repealing the individual mandate will lead to adverse selection in these healthcare marketplaces when healthy people drop their coverage and insurers have to raise prices to take care of sicker people. So that's an open question. Senator Corker was a no. I don't think he's going to be a yes unless this bill comes close to, at least comes close to, if not fully, pays for itself, which it's nowhere near right now. So those two are certainly question marks. And the others, we haven't heard enough, I think, to jeopardize, to put any of the other 50 votes in question at the moment.
Of course, the conditions that Senator Collins was concerned about are not in the tax bill. They're in separate legislation. They were essentially just a promise to her, right?
Correct. The promise was that Congress would pass them by the end of the year. Now, she's not demanding that they're included in the tax bill itself, but yes, she wants them passed, and now it's not clear they can.
Okay, that's Sahil Kapoor, and he is a national political reporter from Bloomberg News. Sahil, please stay with us. We're going to go now to Gordon Gray. He's a director of fiscal policy at the American Action Forum. That's a group that advocates free market solutions. He's also a former staff member on the Senate Budget Committee and deputy director of domestic and economic policy for Senator McCain's presidential campaign. His new article is headlined, What to Make of the Joint Committee on Taxation Dynamic Score. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Thank you for joining us, Gordon.
Hi, Tom. Thanks so much for having me on.
Okay, dynamic tax score. What does that mean? Your specialty here is sort of modeling. What does it mean to even try to score a tax bill?
Sure. Yes. Unfortunately, we've already sort of leapt from trying to explain to folks how tax policy works to having to talk about jargon. And scoring in this context is jargon for how much is something going to cost. When Congress contemplates legislation that changes taxes or changes spending, they ask 2 agencies within the Congress, the Congressional Budget Office and the Joint Committee on Taxation, to come up with estimates for how much that's going to cost. And those cost estimates are colloquially referred to as scores. Now, the way they typically do these, quote, scores is to assume that the economy doesn't change in size. So no matter what the policy is, they have to assume a fixed GDP. And within that, they can do behavioral effects and other things, but one of the rules of these agencies is that they just have to assume that the economy doesn't change, and that's what's called static scoring. Dynamic scoring is when they're given sort of the additional dimension of figuring out, okay, how much does this cost, and then What is the relationship between the cost and the economic effects? And in this case, they can assume that the economy might grow depending on the policy change, or even in some cases contract depending on the policy change, and how will that affect the cost? That's the, quote, dynamic scoring that, that I was talking about.
Well, Gordon, I'm curious, you're talking about how they do this, but how much confidence do you have in this exercise? I think in one of your articles you called it, or modeling in general on the economy, more of an art than a science.
That's correct. Or I would add a little nuance that there is quite a bit of art to the science, and that's just a function of the what we're asking analysts to do when they do these models is to essentially first they have to predict or project what the economy would do if Congress didn't make any changes to laws. So that's called the baseline. And so what forecasters do is they just have to guess, essentially. It's an informed guess, a very well-informed guess, about what the economy would look like from now and then even 10 years from now. And then on top of that, they have to say, okay, well, let's look at this complicated piece of legislation and then figure out how that would change the economy. And then they have to do that over 10 years. And the way you do that is with different kinds of economic models. Now, a model, just think about like an airplane model. So, you know, one you could buy in like a hobby shop or something. Now, you can get a model that, you know, looks just like the airplane that it's supposed to. You know, it's got stickers and all the right paintings on its wings and stuff, but if you picked it up and tried to throw it out a window, it would crash.
This is On Point. I'm Tom Gelton. We're talking about the massive tax cuts proposed for American corporations. You can join our conversation. Are you worried about the effect these business tax cuts will have on the deficit? Follow us on Twitter, and you can find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm talking to Sahil Kapoor. He is the national business reporter for Bloomberg News, and he's been following the tax bill negotiations closely. Also, Gordon Gray, the director of fiscal policy at the American Action Forum. That's a 501c3 group that advocates free market solutions. And Gordon, you were doing your best to explain modeling and dynamic scoring to our lay audience here before the break. Just finishing up, the big question to me, Gordon, is are these scores, are the modeling assumptions good enough that we can say when, you know, when Republicans or President Trump say this is going to help the economy, we can believe them, or when Democrats say it's not going to help the economy that much? How do we know which ones to believe based on these projections?
Sure. So just to complete the earlier point, is that just that these models are by design, oversimplifications of the economy. And in making those oversimplifications to sort of test experiments like, okay, what would the economy do if we, say, did a big corporate tax cut? You know, you have to make a lot of assumptions, and that's what we trust these analysts to do. And we hope, a lot of these analysts are professionals and they're diligent.
They're nonpartisan, assumedly, right? Sure. They're nonpartisan.
The ones at the Joint Committee on Tax are avowedly nonpartisan. It's a federal agency comprised of career analysts. And the way they go about building these models is based on the academic literature. What is the theoretical and the empirical evidence brought to bear on the questions that they're modeling? And so, for example, on the corporate tax, there is an emerging consensus, a strong consensus that the corporate tax does negatively inhibit investment. Investment is essential to productivity and wage growth, and that's one of the key elements of one of the fundamental tenets of this part of the tax reform is that you reduce the corporate tax, you get higher investment, higher productivity, and better wages.
So at the beginning of the program, I pointed out that President Trump's original idea was to cut the corporate tax rate from 35% all the way down to 15%.
It has come back up to 20 in some of the proposals.
Right.
But President Trump, talking to reporters outside his helicopter, Marine One, on his way to New York City back on December 2nd, saying that ultimately that tax rate cut could just be 22%.
Business tax all the way down from 35 to 20. It could be 22 when it comes out, could also be 20. We're going to see what ultimately comes out.
So 35 to 20, and then 35 to 15, and up to 20, maybe 22. I want to go back to you now, Sahil Kapoor from Bloomberg News. What's the latest on where are you predicting this is going to end up? As a 20% tax rate cut, a cut to 20%, or a cut to 22%?
Right. It's an open question right now. We don't quite know where that's going to land. President Trump initially started with a red line of 15%, then he moved that up to 20%.
Right.
There are some Republican senators who want to move it, who want to move that 20% up, rate up just a little bit, perhaps to 21%, perhaps to 22% to make up for revenue that they desperately need if they want a more generous pass-through deduction. There's talk of expanding the state and local property tax exemption to income taxes as well. That sort of thing is going to cost a lot of money, and there is a lot of money to be raised if you set the corporate tax rate at 22% instead of 20%. That's about a difference of $200 billion over 10 years. So the truth is it's an open question right now. Negotiations are very secretive. None of this is being done out in the open. It's being hashed out privately between Republican and Republican. We'll find out soon.
Okay. And now we're going to hear from Stephen Rosenthal. He's in Washington, where he's senior fellow at the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center, and he focuses on business taxes there. Before joining Urban, he was a tax lawyer and a legislation counsel with the Joint Committee on Taxation. He's also the former chair of the taxation section of the D.C. Bar Association, so he knows a lot about business tax issues, and he is got a journal article that is titled Slashing Corporate Taxes. Foreign investors are the surprise winners. You can link to that at our website, onpointradio.org. And Steve Rosenthal, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom.
So let's see. First of all, Gordon Gray actually briefly mentioned this before, but I want you to revisit it. How is it that cutting business taxes will help, let's say, workers?
Well, the argument is a long-run argument that as the U.S. lowers its corporate tax rates, we will attract new investment capital. That new investment capital will be used by corporations to buy a lot of new equipment for their businesses. That new investment in equipment will make U.S. workers more productive. And finally, that productivity growth will translate into higher wages to the extent that workers can negotiate higher wages. So a four-step process, again, long run, and the long run could take many, many years.
Right. And the idea is right now that when the United States has higher corporate tax rates than our other than other countries, then businesses are tempted to do more of their business overseas or keep their earnings overseas because they don't have to pay tax on them until they come back. Is it realistic to think that lowering that tax rate will sort of prompt a lot of corporations to bring back operations here that they otherwise wouldn't have?
Depends on the final drafting of the legislation. That is, today we have a 35% corporate tax rate on profits in the U.S. And we also tax at 35% profits abroad, but only when those profits are repatriated to the U.S. The consequence has been that multinationals have allowed trillions of dollars to be booked abroad and not repatriated to the U.S., at least not to the books of the U.S. corporation, parent corporation.
Go ahead, Steve. Finish your thought.
I was just going to say that we are addressing that situation by exempting foreign profits and allowing foreign profits to be returned to the U.S. without any additional taxes. So the plan is to both lower the 35% rate to 20% and then to exempt foreign profits. That introduces its own problems, set of problems, as I have written about, that we still have a gap between the U.S. 20% rate and the foreign 0% rate, and there still will be an incentive for U.S. companies to shift jobs, factories, and profits offshore. The Congress is trying to do something about that gap by creating so-called guardrails. I don't think those guardrails work very well. So the jury is still out when the dust settles whether U.S. corporations will increase or decrease their activity in the U.S.
But Steve, just bottom line here, you think it's a good idea to lower the corporate tax rate?
Yes, I think lowering the corporate tax rate makes sense, but I would not have lowered the corporate tax rate in the way that Congress is doing. I would have lowered the corporate tax rate by closing loopholes for corporations and trying to keep the revenue loss down. As it is, the largest single revenue loss in the pending tax bill is slashing corporate tax rates from 35 to 20%. That loses $1.5 trillion over 10 years. And as Sahil observed, if we slash it to 21 or 22, we can reduce that $1.5 trillion to $1.4 or $1.3 trillion, but still a large number.
Right. Well, I hope our listeners are following this discussion because it's really important. And Steve, I think in one of your articles, you acknowledge that this is complicated business, even for tax lawyers. So I do appreciate everyone's efforts to keep it sort of user-friendly here. Let's go now to Jeffrey, who is on the line from Des Moines. Jeffrey, you are on point. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, in the 40s and 50s and 60s, when the United States had a vibrant middle class and about 4 to 6% growth, corporations were paying about a dollar of taxes for every dollar that individuals paid. Today, they are paying, by most estimates, somewhere from 10 to 20 cents for every dollar that you and I pay. So this corporations, large ones, are paying historically low compared to the 40s, 50s, and 60s and other portions when we had a much more stable society. And Applebee's and other huge corporations are not going to open another restaurant if there's not demand. 70% of our economy is based on consumer spending. If people do not have enough money in their pockets, there's no large, giant corporation that has an incentive for more production or distribution.
Well, that's a really important point. And let's go to you on that, Stephen. What's the prospect of, if companies have more profits, if they're earning higher profits because of lower tax rates, what's the, why should we assume that they're going to invest that extra profits as opposed to sort of buying back their own shares or, building up their cash reserves or something like that?
Well, I think a leap of faith to assume that higher corporate profits will result in more wages to workers or even potentially more investment in the U.S. The caller is correct. Our collections from corporations have dramatically diminished over the last few decades, largely because corporations can shield their profits offshore. Now, what should we do about that? We do live in a global economy in which our corporations compete abroad, but there still is a question of how to structure a tax system so we set the rate correctly and eliminate loopholes. I think we've done both too far in this bill. The rate is too low, and we have not tackled loopholes as aggressively as we should have.
Now, Jeffrey raised another or hinted at another question, which is that just because corporations pay 35% tax rate doesn't mean that they are hugely disadvantaged as a result of those tax rates, because there are many other factors, right, that affect how many the tax liability of a company. There are deductions, there are credits, et cetera. So how do we sort of assess, what some of those other factors are in determining a company's tax liability? Isn't there more to a company's tax burden than simply than what is reflected in the corporate tax rate? Steve?
Certainly. When you look at the statistic effective tax rate and you look to how U.S. multinationals pay taxes relative to their actual income, the effective tax rate is in the low to mid-20s, competitive with other countries. Now, the issue is then, why is it so low? In large measure, because we allow lots of loopholes, most principally the ability to shift profits offshore and defer any taxation until the profits are returned. And so to talk about our corporate rate 35% is nominally too high compared to other countries is somewhat misleading in that what we really should look at is the actual taxes that are paid mm-hmm. by corporations.
Right. And let's go now to Jacob, who is on the line from Austin, Texas. Jacob, you are with On Point. Thanks for calling us.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I had a comment I believe y'all are just touching on, but I had a couple of things. What y'all were just saying is kind of in tandem with what I had to say. I was just looking historically at when you have, you know, we already have high rates of capital in this country, I think higher than we've ever had. And it doesn't appear to be being reinvested at this point into labor force or into supplying for demand. It seems to be into stock buybacks, into mergers, into overseas offshore accounts. And so if you look at third developing world models as opposed to developed world models, the tendency when large corporations get larger amounts of wealth is not to reinvest and to create demand. Only and if you look, and also to also touch on in Europe, also don't forget when we look at the competitive tax rates in Europe, they also have the when people buy luxury goods, extremely wealthy people buy luxury goods. They get taxed pretty heavily. We don't have that here.
Okay, Jacob. So, this is the issue we mentioned earlier, and I gave Steve Rosenthal a chance to comment on it. Now I want Gordon Gray to weigh in on it. The same question, Gordon. Can we assume that the profits that companies earn from lower tax rates are going to be reinvested, or might they just use that capital some other way?
Right. So I've heard this argument, and I think it's important to introduce or distinguish between sort of what the tax policy change is supposed to do and sort of what we're talking about is animating the wage changes. The there is a literature that identifies how profit can be, you know, can and would be shared to the extent that the tax change increases profit among workers, but that's actually not really where the heart of the theory is with respect to how the corporate rate affects wages. It's not about profits, because profits can be generated by any number of sort of incidental factors. Rather, the theory is about does the change in the corporate rate incentivize investment? Does it make workers more productive, as Steve said, over the long run? And so to the extent that we have a long-run productivity problem, that's one of the elements that I think if anybody looked at how the economy is projected to operate over the next 10 years, we'd say, we'd like to improve productivity. We'd like to improve labor supply. What are the tools that we can deploy to do that? Well, how do you improve productivity is you increase investment. And that's where a lot of the literature on how the corporate rate, can be brought to bear, on our long-term, sort of slow economic challenges is actually on the investment and productivity element there.
So, Gordon, very quickly, do you have your own estimate about how many companies would actually come back to the United States as a result of this change?
My own estimate, no. I have not modeled that. What I have actually looked at how current law and how some sort of the patchwork tax policies or approaches that we've seen recently could actually adversely shift more jobs overseas. Because right now there is, if you look at John Diamond and George Odrow did a study on this, that right now there is sort of pressure to, under the current law, to see companies move overseas. This inversion issue that we've seen lots of times. And, you know, I've seen tens of thousands of jobs just looking at headquarter staffing that these companies have are currently at risk under the current tax code.
Well, that's another whole issue. Gordon Gray, Director of Fiscal Policy at the American Action Forum. Thank you, Gordon, for joining our conversation. And Stephen Rosenthal from the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. Thank you, Steve, for joining us.
You're welcome.
This is On Point. I'm Tom Gelton. And this hour, we're looking at the tax bill that's in the final stage of negotiation in Congress and what it might mean for the economy and for all of us. And, of course, a big part of that is the cut in corporate tax rates. Well, we were talking about that early in the program, and not surprisingly, listeners have a lot to say about that. Denault, a listener writing on Twitter, says the tax cut for corporations will not invest in growth or wages. They will invest in increased dividends. Kelly writes, why have they not looked at increased dependent flex spend, Max? That could easily save middle-class families with kids at the house. I'm not sure exactly what she what we can think about that a little bit more. Bill says the GOP has an ongoing theory that cutting corporate taxes leads to economic growth and jobs, which might work if we didn't live in a heck with you, got mine society. Of course, he didn't say heck with you, but whatever. Those big tax breaks for corporations will have to be paid for somehow. We got to bring in more tax revenue from somewhere else. One proposal in the House version of the tax bill is to make graduate students pay taxes on their stipends and tuition waivers. And guess what? The students are not very happy about that. They say they won't be able to afford higher education. Graduate degrees could become a luxury item just for those wealthy enough to afford them. In fact, last month, Miriam Rubenstein, a PhD student at the University of Southern California, told her local news channel, ABC 7, that grad students already make meager salaries and they need the tuition waivers in order to effectively continue their studies.
A lot of students are living on the very low stipends that graduate students receive, which is an average of about $18,000 a year for grad students across the country. And that's so that we can do research, we can teach college classes, we can grade papers and mentor students.
And that's Miriam Rubenstein at the University of Southern California. Also, Mina Cato, a graduate student at American University, told NBC Nightly News last month that she might have to drop out of her program if Congress starts to tax tuition waivers.
I already have a student loan that I'm trying to pay off. I don't know if I can take out another student loan, which means I don't know if I can pay to finish my degree.
So the idea here is that those tuition waivers are actually pretty big bucks. And if you have to pay taxes on the amount of money that you are saving by getting a tuition waiver, you could be hit with a big new tax bill. You can join this conversation. Would a tax on graduate stipends and tuition waivers impact you? Would you be able to finish your degree? Would you have to drop out? Follow us on Twitter, and you can find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. And joining us now from Washington is Eric Kelderman. He's a senior reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education, and he has written a number of articles about the House GOP tax plan's possible effect on graduate students. His latest is headlined, How the House GOP Tax Plan Would Affect Grad Students. You can link to it on our website at onpointradio.org. And Eric, thanks for joining us with this important part of the conversation.
Thanks, Tom. Great to be with you.
So, as you have mentioned, written, and we have mentioned, this is a point of difference between the House and Senate plans. The House does include this idea of taxing the amount of money that students get as a result of tuition waivers. The Senate bill does not, right?
That's correct. Yeah, and in fact, there are a number of House members who have begun to push back on this provision as well.
So is this going to go by the wayside? Are we paying too much attention to it right now?
Well, you know, that's a great question. I think I'm sure the folks who follow the politics of this more closely know that there are an enormous number of moving pieces going on in the conference committee. And so, you know, I think it could fall by the wayside. On the other hand, you know, they really need the money to keep the bill under that $1.5 trillion cap that they've set for themselves.
Yeah, let's see if Sahil Kapoor agrees on that prognosis. Sahil has been with us all hour. He's been covering the negotiations for Bloomberg News. Do you agree with that, Sahil, that there seems to be sort of a little bit of a drift away from this idea of taxing tuition waivers?
Yes, I have sensed that there is a drift in the other direction. There are 31 House Republican members who have called on their leadership to drop this provision from the bill. Many of them voted for the tax bill. It's created quite an uproar. The American Council on Education, which represents more than 1,000 colleges and universities, says it would be devastating to graduate education. A lot of their it estimates that it would cost grad students about $65 billion over the next 10 years, and as one of your, as you previously pointed out on the show, a lot of them, you know, don't live with expansive salaries or anything, so this would be a significant hit to them. My sources in the Senate also indicate that there is discontentment with that provision in the Senate as well. That provision did not make it into the Senate bill, which is right. A sign that it may not be in the conference bill if House Republicans are rebelling as well.
Well, guess what? A lot of listeners, especially graduate students, have strong feelings about this idea. Let's go first to Tyler, who's on the line from Columbia, Missouri. Tyler, thanks for calling On Point. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Have you thought about what this would mean for you?
Yeah. Just to share one graduate student's perspective, this would in effect double my tax liability. There was a group of graduate students from UC Berkeley who made a nice little nifty online calculator tool for us to figure out what effect this would have. And basically, it kind of doubles my tax liability, maybe more. We don't make a lot of money to begin with. I think a lot of people might be surprised just to know how little money we make. It's a lot like flipping burgers.
You want to say how much you make?
I make about $26,000 a year.
Wow.
So I'm very fortunate to live in a very affordable and wonderful part of the country. I was previously a graduate student in the University of California, and I was making a little bit less, and you know, the cost of living was almost three times. So for a lot of people, my heart goes out to them because it's really going to cripple you.
Now, Tyler, what's your program? What are you studying?
I study plant genetics.
Mm-hmm.
So I hope to go into the agriculture field. And a lot of us, what we do, we pay our bills by teaching. We teach the undergraduates, and we do research. And just the fact that they're taxing tuition, when in effect a lot of us are not really students, we kind of work as, we're part of the labor force of universities. For example, I'm not taking any classes right now. I just do research.
Yeah. And do you think that this will, I don't know exactly how important, you know, research and expertise in plant genetics is to the future of this country, but, you know, what are some of the effects on sort of the capabilities and expertise in our country in your field, for example, if this were to go through?
Well, I would make the argument that really what this effect would have would be disincentivizing graduate education, particularly in the STEM field, which is where these tuition waivers are so common.
Yeah.
And so in my field, for example,
that's science, remind us,
science, technology, education, and mathematics,
right,
is the STEM acronym.
Right.
But, and I think that it's having this effect of people start to seek education elsewhere, outside of the country, going to Europe, for example, where funding might be a little bit more secure. And then people, after their graduate education, they go and they seek employment elsewhere. And so I think that we'll see a brain drain. And it's really dangerous that in my field, people will start going to Europe to go work for foreign companies like, you know, Bayer or Syngenta. And I think that it's going to result in a lot less talented, educated scientists coming out of the U.S. and
okay.
Agriculture is a big portion of this country's economy, and it would really decimate things, I think.
Sure. Well, thanks for that, Tyler. And Eric Kelderman, this is such a, you know, this is a pretty powerful argument that is this really what we want to disincentivize? Do we really want to sort of discourage graduate students from going to graduate school? How did this provision even come up, and what is the argument that its advocates are making for it?
Honestly, I mean, there hasn't been a lot of strong argument in favor of that particular provision, and I think that's evidenced by the fact that it didn't make it into the Senate bill,
yeah.
and I think the impact on the revenues that it would bring in are pretty minor. I think, like a number of things in the Senate bill, you know, or in the GOP tax overhaul, they were just scrambling to find revenue, really, to pick up to keep the deficit lower than it would have been. This would have there is some argument too that this would change how graduate education is done in the U.S. That maybe colleges would restructure their graduate plans to make them scholarship based and make the teaching and research assistantships optional, but that would still have a pretty big impact in how we conduct graduate education in the country.
Sahil Kapoor. So the idea here is that if you're going to cut taxes, you're going to cut revenue. If you cut taxes, you cut revenue. So you have to, unless you want to blow up the deficit, you got to find some other place to bring in more tax revenue to compensate for what you're losing. If this provision of increasing or taxing tuition waivers goes by the wayside, are there some other proposals to come up with that needed revenue?
Right. Well, that's one of the big things that tax negotiators are wrestling with at the moment. Another big difference between the House and Senate bills, to your point here, is the issue of the AMT, the alternative minimum tax. The House bill eliminates that on individuals and corporations, whereas the Senate bill keeps it for corporations and preserves large chunks of it for individuals. These are hundreds of billions of dollars that they're saving with that. That's one of the things that conference negotiators might use to save money in the bill. But look, if we're talking about this grad school tuition waiver tax, it's not a lot of money being raised. We're talking billions of dollars, maybe tens of billions of dollars, in the grand scheme of a $1.5 trillion net addition to the deficit. It's not an enormous amount of money. There are other issues, you know, like the corporate tax rate cut. Again, a single percentage point yields $100 billion. The real money is not in this grad school piece, which is one of the reasons there's such an outcry, and which is one of the reasons mm-hmm. that I think negotiators are moving away from including it.
Let's go now to, well, we got a lot of graduate students calling in, and they're all essentially making the same points. They're not happy about this. Let's give Andy a shot. He's calling from Atlanta, Georgia. Andy, thanks for calling On Point.
Hi, Tom. Yeah, I would like to point out the fact, too, that, I mean, not only is this bill going to de-incentivize higher education, it's also going to price graduate school out of the realm of most working-class families. And then when you add the state and local sales tax changes in the new tax bill, that puts a lot of your Ivy League schools out of reach for the children of working class families, which, I mean, that de-incentivizes the work and the effort that, I mean, that originally that was what our education system was built on. And this is going to gut it. And you're not going to make up the deficit on the backs of graduate students. That's just ludicrous.
Right. And your point, as we said at the beginning, if only the wealthiest can afford to go to graduate school, you're cutting off that option for a lot of working class Americans.
Right. I mean, there's a lot more working class Americans than there are wealthy Americans.
Yeah. Well, there's some pretty powerful arguments against this provision, as we've heard. And Sahil, you and Eric Kelderman are both agreeing that this may not last. The concern here, though, is if there is a big tax cut, it's going to increase the deficit, and an increased deficit could bring actually too much economic growth, which would mean higher tax rates, et cetera. Sahil, very quickly, how much talk is there about the implications of a bigger deficit? I mean, Republicans have been deficit hawks, fiscal hawks for a long time. Are they now prepared to deal with a much bigger deficit if they can't agree on where they're going to find the revenue to cut it?
Well, the short answer is yes. They agree that they'll tolerate up to $1.5 trillion in deficits, at least before economic growth is factored in. The issue of dynamic scoring, as you talked about earlier in the show. Now, this is where the debate gets more contentious, because Republicans are insisting pretty much up and down the spectrum that this tax bill will end up paying for itself with economic growth. There's no credible study that suggests that. There are various studies that suggest it could yield somewhere in the neighborhood of $300 billion to $500 billion in economic growth. So that reduces the cost of the bill to $1 trillion from $1.5 trillion. It's still a pretty big increase in the deficit. I should say Republicans tend not to be deficit hawks when it comes to tax cuts. They tend to be anti-spending. We've seen this since the Reagan era. There were a series of steep tax cuts that led to spending cuts. We saw it in the Bush era as well, steep tax cuts, and the response to that was when President Obama came into power, the deficit was large. He ended up cutting a lot of spending. So mm-hmm. there's a bit of a cycle going on here, mm-hmm. you know, where the government ends up shrinking overall in the long term as a result of all of this.
Yeah, well, and we should point out that Speaker Paul Ryan has already signaled that after this tax bill is completed, they're going to turn their attention to cutting entitlement spending, which could mean cuts to Social Security and Medicaid. Eric Kelderman, a very quick final thought from you on what you see happening. Very quick.
Well, I think that even if this provision on taxing tuition waivers goes away, there are measures in the bill that could have much more fundamental and very significant impacts on the bottom line for states, which would cut into both K-12 and higher ed, and also on institutional fundraising, limiting the number of taxpayers who can itemize their charitable deductions is thought to be could be very damaging to fundraising efforts at all institutions of higher education.
Yeah, so that's not the only, the tuition waivers is not the only issue. A lot of issues here for colleges and universities, and I assume they are weighing in quite heavily on this. I'm betting you're seeing a lot of lobbying by colleges and universities.
Almost every day, sure, we're seeing statements by the major higher ed associations, trying to nix some of these things. But frankly, for instance, doubling the Stanford deduction, which seems in the final legislation, would also have a big impact on state budgets, for instance. And exactly. I don't think that's going away.
Okay. Well, Eric Kelderman, thank you so much. He's a senior reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education. And we also have had Sahil Kapoor, national political reporter for Bloomberg News. Thank you for joining us, Sahil.
Thanks for having me.
And
thanks a lot, Tom.
You bet. And you can continue the conversation, and you can get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter. You can find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Now, coming up tomorrow, the message from Alabama after that special election that has roiled the nation. Now what for Washington and the country? That's tomorrow, On Point. I'm Tom Jelton. And this is On Point.